So I want to tell you about some work that Mark Scheel and I have been thinking about, having to do with how do you choose gauge conditions for doing dynamical space-time evolutions. So we all know that the gauge fields, which I'm calling the gauge fields, the lapse and the shift, can be chosen quite freely. But if you make bad choices, you will run into a variety of different kinds of trouble. So for example, you could, in principle, write down conditions for these fields which would generate shocks or coordinate singularities as you evolve along. So you want to try to avoid that. You could write down equations for the gauge fields which are so badly chosen that they might even be ill-posed, so you couldn't even predict how the system would behave in the future. You could write down systems which are well-behaved, but the algorithms for computing the time updates of the new field might be so expensive or inefficient that it would slow down the evolution so much that it would really be impractical. Or you might get all of the above right, but you may end up with gauge conditions which end up representing what are in fact very simple geometries in extremely complicated ways. And if possible, you'd like to avoid that as well. So Mark and I set out to try to use all of the wisdom we could extract from everybody who's been working on these issues for decades to try to come up with a system that we would use that would address all of these different issues. So in particular, we've chosen gauge conditions which attempt to represent stationary geometries in a time-independent way. So if you have a merging black hole and eventually settles down to a time-independent Kerr solution, you would like your representation of that to really be independent of your time coordinate. In order to avoid shocks, we've imposed something called linear degeneracy in the evolution equations. I'll talk a bit more about what that is and why people think that should solve the shock problem. And finally, we want to write down equations for the evolution of the gauge fields which form together with all of the rest of the dynamical fields a really unified symmetric hyperbolic evolution system. Hyperbolic equations are much cheaper to solve than, say, elliptic conditions, which you might write down for gauge conditions. And so that's the route we decided to go. So let me talk about each of those things individually and tell you what we've done about them. So let's first talk about the idea of representing stationary spacetimes in a time-independent way. So if you've got a stationary spacetime, you can always choose the time coordinate, dy dt, so that it is the time-like Killing field. When you write out the 3 plus 1 representation of the Einstein equations, for example, if you write down the time derivative of the trace of the extrinsic curvature, that gives you this standard expression, which involves an elliptic operator operating on the lapse plus other lower order terms. So one of the things you could do is set this equal to 0 as your gauge condition, and that forces the standard elliptic kind of condition on the lapse. So many people have suggested using this over the years. Similarly, you can do something with a shift. You take the time derivative of the trace. This is the three-dimensional connection coefficient associated with the 3 metric. When you write out what that is, you get terms which I've written in terms of this tensor sigma, which is just the time derivative of the 3 metric. And it involves just this shear of the shift function. And so this differential equation, if you set that equal to 0 as your gauge condition, would involve the divergence of this shear of the shift, which is the standard elliptic operator on the shift. So setting that equal to 0 is among the standard elliptic type gauge conditions that people have imposed. So elliptic equations, although they're much more efficiently solved these days than they were historically, it's still very expensive to solve elliptic conditions. I think the code that Harold Pfeiffer is working, Barry can probably give me the exact number, but it's something like between an order of magnitude and 2 orders of magnitude slower to solve a scalar equation using an elliptic system than it is to do a time update as a hyperbolic system. So, I mean, it's cheaper than it was, but it still would really slow down the code. So you would, if possible, like to get away with doing things in a hyperbolic way. So our strategy for doing this, and again, this we weren't the first people to have thought of that, is to take these elliptic equations and promote them to hyperbolic equations by adding suitable time derivatives. So for example, here's an equation where I've taken this time derivative of k, which is just something like the Laplacian of the lapse, and instead of setting it equal to 0, I'm going to set it equal to the second time derivative of the lapse plus maybe some damping term. Anyway, you want to write down something that looks like a wave type equation. Time derivatives then equal this Laplacian event on the right hand side. And similarly with the shift, you take second time derivative terms and set them equal to this term on the right that is effectively this elliptic operator operating on the shift vector. So that's our strategy, and that's something that was proposed by other people. The Potsdam group and Alcubierre and people have talked about doing this, and they've had some numerical success in implementing them. So we're following along in their footsteps. Yeah, so those are constants that you could fiddle with, and I'll talk more about fiddling with constants.
Why would that tend to, is it could you be clear why that would tend to freeze k and gamma?
So if k and gamma freeze, then this will drive the lapse into something that satisfies the usual kind of condition. Okay, what isn't clear is whether this entire system will settle down to be time independent. Okay, so my understanding of the numerical experience from the Potsdam group is that in fact it works. We haven't quite got our code to the point that we can test it yet. So we'll have a empirical viewpoint for you soon, I hope. But if the mathematicians out there would like to tell us how to design equations which have the property that they would guarantee that you would push the solution toward a time-independent representation in it when the geometry itself becomes time-independent, we would be more than happy to learn how to do that more efficiently. This was just our attempt at doing that.
You want to see with hyperbolic equations, because parabolic,
yeah, so it's easy, but you have lousy Courant conditions, so that actually slows you down too. So if you can do it with hyperbolic equations, that would really be the most preferable thing. So, I mean, there's many ways you can go. This is sort of the strategy we... Another problem with parabolic equations, see, I think I mentioned that one of the disadvantages of using these elliptic equations here is that in general, we don't have a sort of generic well-Posness theorem that tells us when you have a hyperbolic system which is coupled to an elliptic system, when is the whole combined system really well-posed. Now, Vince and Lars Anderson have proven some well-Posness theorems for specific forms of the Einstein equations, which are in fact very similar to imposing this kind of gauge conditions. But if you want to shift things a little bit, then what you have to do is somehow get Vince to reprove the theorem. And that's, you know, Vince has a lot of other things to do. And similarly, if you had a parabolic system, then sort of, I don't know of any well-Posness theorem. So it would be nice to know that what you're doing is sort of generically makes sense. If we make the whole thing honestly hyperbolic, then at least up to boundary type terms, we know that we're doing something which is sensible.
So,
pardon? Okay. So let me talk about the next issue, which this is avoidance of gauge shocks. So this is done by imposing something called linear degeneracy condition on the equation. So let me tell you what that is. So let's consider a sort of generic first order system of hyperbolic equations. So these U alphas are your list of fields. There's some matrices which can depend on the fields times spatial derivatives. And then there's some term on the right, which also depends on the fields algebraically, but not on the derivatives. You define the characteristic speeds and characteristic fields associated with this matrix as simply the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. You pick a direction, this n just is the normal form to the direction you're interested in, and then this gives you a matrix, so ei is the ith eigenvector, and vi is the eigenvalue associated with that. So that gives you the list of speeds at which sort of high frequency signals propagate in the theory. The system is called, okay, so these VIs and EIs, of course, depend on the As, and the As depend on the fields. Okay, so linear degeneracy is defined as having the property that when you look at the dependence of the ith eigenvalue on the field, so we take its partial derivative with respect to the field variables, and evaluate that in the direction of the ith eigenvector, you get zero. That is, if you go along the characteristic associated with a particular field, that the speed in that direction is constant. So any such eigenvector is called linearly degenerate if the system has the property that all of the such eigenvectors are linear or have this linear degeneracy property, then we call the whole system linearly degenerate. So the folklore is that if you start out with smooth initial data, then that data will not form shocks if you evolve it with a linearly degenerate evolution system. So I can find an article in the literature which proves that for the case where there's no F and for the case where it's one-dimensional. So instead of something over K, you just have an X-dimensional or just propagation in the X direction. Then there's a paper by Liu back in the mid-70s. Good. So I was hoping that somebody would tell me where the real theorem is. So I'll talk to you later, and then I'll refer to that in the future. So is the folklore right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So we have it from the highest authority. Yes.
Lach was the first to work on this kind of thing.
Right.
But for one scale dimension.
Okay. Good.
So presumably the fluid equations cannot be written in a form that's satisfied.
Well, so the fluid equations have the property that I think two of the characteristic speeds fail to satisfy this. They're not zero.
Yeah.
And then there's some that are zero. So, and people to show that for the fluid equations, you get shocks only in the characteristic directions corresponding to the cases where this is not zero.
Yeah.
And in the other directions, you can have, if you have discontinuities in the initial data,
yeah,
then they will propagate, they'll just stay there. So like if you have the density discontinuity because you have a phase transition or the temperature is discontinuous or something, that can just freeze there, but you don't develop a shock as that goes along. Okay?
Wouldn't the shock be the same thing as having grid lines across, or is it something? What is it?
So it's, I mean, if you write down, so we're writing down hyperbolic equations, in principle at some place where the fields become discontinuous or presumably crossing is a horrible example of that. There's probably more subtle versions as well. But in any, pardon?
So the fields become discontinuous, but I mean, what is a coordinate shock? It's not really there. There's some transformation.
Yeah, it's a coordinate shock. I mean, it's not a physical.
I mean, I presume that it's just your. The underlying geometry hasn't, so what I think of as a gauge shock is something where the underlying geometry is in fact well behaved and smooth, something like crossing of coordinates or perhaps more subtle versions of that.
So no disassembly in the curvature, but even some other gauge dependent.
But all of these gauge dependent quantities that you're using to evolve can be horrible and they can crash the computer code, right? You sort of go along and then you're
that.
In. Okay, so that's the definition. How do you avoid that? So let me talk a little bit about why the regular Einstein equations are thought to be okay in terms of this. So if you look at these characteristic matrices for the Einstein equations, in fact, they only depend on the metric field. They depend on the lapse and shift in the three metric. You just write out the evolution equations. And therefore, the characteristic speeds, the eigenvalues of these, will also only depend on these metric fields. Now, typically, unless you do something fairly perverse, all of the systems that I've looked at, the characteristic speeds, in fact, are very simple. They're all linear in the lapse times a bunch of numbers which depend on what particular representation of the equations you're writing down, but they don't depend on space. They're just some set of numbers, 1, minus a half, 0, etc. And then there is this shift correction term that just tells you how fast the coordinates are moving. Okay, so the total dependence of V on the metric is just through the lapse and shift. It doesn't depend on the three metric at all. That's not too surprising. You can't build any invariant scalars out of a tensor. Okay, so that's how these VIs depend on the fields. The only Einstein equation that involves derivatives of the metric is just this, it's basically the definition of the extrinsic curvature, so there's the usual time derivative plus lead derivative of g term. So if you think in terms of fixing the lapse and shift, so if we consider this shift to be some fixed predetermined function on space, then the only derivatives in this equation are these pieces. And so the A matrix only depends on this n. It's just n times the identity delta alpha beta. And therefore, the characteristic speeds in this case have none of this lapse piece, and they have only this n dot nk piece, which doesn't depend on the three metric at all. So when you take the partial derivative of the characteristic speed with respect to the metric, you get zero for these GIJs. So that's the usual argument that says that if you fix the gauge fields, that the dynamical fields in relativity satisfy a linearly degenerate evolution equation. So now we're going to add differential equations to evolve the lapse and shift. We have to do it in such a way that we also keep the derivatives of these characteristic fields with respect to the lapse and shift being zero. And the easiest way to accomplish that is to make sure that the principal parts, that is the A matrix part of the lapse evolution equation, is just zero, okay, plus the F terms, the algebraic pieces, and will guarantee that the shift evolution equation is also zero. Okay, so if we do that, that means these characteristic speeds in the direction of the lapse and shift will just be zero. So when you take the partial derivatives to find out whether that speed is changing as you go along those characteristic directions, you'll just get zero because it will appear zero in all cases. So if we can do that, and since we'll have a large amount of freedom to fiddle with these equations, we can choose them any way we want, we'll just fix them to be this, and that will guarantee linear degeneracy of the whole coupled unified system. Okay, so I've talked about addressing the stationarity problem. I've talked about the linear degeneracy problem. Now we want to do is combine these sort of fiducial equations that we've written down for the lapse and shift, these wave-like equations. We have to somehow combine those with the rest of the Einstein equations and make sure that the full coupled system is still hyperbolic, right? So this certainly looks like a hyperbolic equation as long as you're fixing all of the other fields, the three metric and the extrinsic curvature and things. But when you couple these with the rest of the Einstein equations, it's not so obvious. So this is how we set about to do that. The first thing we did, and in hindsight, I'm not sure this was actually, it seemed clever at the time, but I think if we're going to do it again, which we might, we wouldn't do this. If you look at this equation, you'll notice there's a time derivative in every piece. So you're tempted to try to integrate this analytically, okay? So when I wrote inequality here, I said this was a fiducial equation. I really meant I want this to be hyperbolic, so I could add sort of lower order terms here and I wouldn't really care. I would consider that to be the same equation. So up to the addition of lower order pieces, I really can integrate this explicitly. So for example, the integral of this equation looks something like this. So the integral of this first term is just one time derivative of n, and then there'll be some time-independent piece, I'd call it n0, sort of a function of integration that could go in there. And there are other pieces, so this kappa, I've now written this kappa L, and you integrate this and you get n minus n0, this fiducial piece. On the right, you get k minus k0, and I've added some other stuff to make the sort of three steps down the line, the equation come out nice, but which still has the property, when you take a time derivative of this, you get the same principal part as the equation we started with. And similarly for the shift equation, I can do an integral of this, and I get from this piece something that looks like a shift minus some time-independent function of integration and other terms.
So you essentially can add the order of terms without changing the character of the equation, but does it still preserve the property you were looking for in the beginning?
Sure. So the only kind of extra terms that I'm adding are these time-independent pieces. So I don't think it changes that.
No, but I mean, if I could, would you go to a constant mean curvature slicing, or would you go to that kind of situation?
So I mean, our hope is, and I don't have any experimental tests to back this up yet. If we waited a few more weeks, maybe I'll have some result. Our hope is that K will approach whatever this K0 is that you stick in there. So if you want to go to constant mean curvature slicing, you choose, is this K0 the appropriate constant for that? And for this N0, you put in the lapse that corresponds to your, you know, the Kerr solution that you hope to settle down to in this CMC slicing, or whatever it is you want to do. So we don't have a proof that this actually converges to that. So for basically computational reasons, it was simpler analytically to deal with this system than this. I said I'm not sure that's actually the best thing to do, but that's what we. No, so we'll be evolving this system, or some version of that. Yeah, so it reduces the number of variables that you have to carry. You don't have to carry an extra time derivative of these guys, so it saves you five fields, and the matrices are 46 by 46 instead of 50 by 50, and so that helps Mathematica a little bit, etc. Okay, so these equations are hyperbolic by construction. They also have the property that they do satisfy our linear degeneracy conditions. So you notice in this equation, there is a term that looks like n dot grad n. But grad n will be taken over and will be a new dynamical field when you turn this into a first order system. And similarly, n dot grad n, so this is actually, term actually looks like a disaster. That's the typical kind of term in fluid mechanics that really does generate shocks. But this grad n, again, will be its own dynamical field. So this term will become an algebraic term on the right-hand side of the equation, not part of the principal part.
For both fields as well.
Yes, and the way you get those is you take gradients of these two equations. Okay, it's the usual trick you play with scalar wave equations. Okay, so those are the actual system of equations. We would deal with these first-order ones. So let's write down the list of all of the dynamical fields that we're going to have in our system. We have these metric variables, spatial metric, lapse and shift. We have the extrinsic curvature, which is basically the time derivative of G. We should have had time derivatives of N and Ni, but by going to this integrated, once integrated form, we can avoid that. And then we have spatial derivatives of the metric, the lapse, and the shift as being new independent fields. So there are 46 independent components of that. When you now write down all of these equations, again, it falls into this standard quasi-linear first-order form. Time derivative of these guys is equal to some matrix that depends on the U's. It actually depends only in the metric fields, as before. And then there's some horrible nonlinear right-hand side. To decide whether that kind of system is actually hyperbolic, the nicest definition in terms of having these theorems, as people have talked about many times in this workshop, is to require that it be symmetric hyperbolic. And that means that we want to have this symmetrizer, or I think of it as a metric on the space of fields, S alpha theta, it's some positive definite 46 by 46 matrix, which has the property that if you use it to lower this index on these characteristic fields, so we've now turned this into AK alpha beta, we want that to be symmetric in alpha and beta for each value of K. So if you have a positive definite S which symmetrizes things, then the system is called symmetric hyperbolic, and then there are lots of nice theorems about well-posedness of the initial value problem. So we need to construct such an S for our system. That is the exact system with these variables, with the gauge evolution equations, with the Einstein equations. So how do you do that? Well, let's start out by just writing out what do these S alpha betas look like. So let me use the usual relativist kind of notation for metrics. So these F alpha beta du alpha is just the sort of field one form. So what kind of form can this have? So I've just written down a couple of terms. You could have some constant times the d in the trace k direction. So that's one nice positive definite term. You can have another term that looks like take k's and contract, so kij, so we contract the first index and the second index with the 3 metric and multiply that by a different constant, etc. And so you can just write out lots of different terms using only the metric and constants to construct it. In fact, when you do that, it turns out there are exactly 19 terms that you can write out that are constructed out of constants plus the metric. Why do I limit myself to the metric? Well, if you go back to the Einstein equations, this A for all of these systems has the form, it's the lapse times some function of the three metric plus the shift times the identity matrix. So the part that really needs to be symmetrized is just a lapse times something that's constructed out of the three metric. And so if you're going to symmetrize it, it also should be something that's just constructed out of the three metric. Okay, so this is really the most general form of that kind of symmetrizer you could think of. There are exactly 19 parameters when you do that for this system that we're talking about here. So the bad news is when you take this completely general S alpha beta and multiply it by the characteristic matrix, the A, that corresponds to that system, in fact, you can show that there is no choice of this 19 parameters that makes it symmetric. You're just dead. Okay, well, this isn't a surprise to anybody who's working the Einstein equation. You have to use a trick, and the trick was invented by, I don't know, God or Jimmy York or some other exalted being like that. And the idea was that you can add to the Einstein equations multiples of the constraints that should be zero if you really have a solution of the Einstein equations, but which nevertheless change the dynamical form of the equation. They contribute terms to the characteristic matrix. So the standard constraints, there's the usual Hamiltonian, momentum constraints. This is a constraint that just comes from the fact that this D really should have been the partial derivative of the metric. So if you take another derivative anti-symmetrize, you should get zero. And we have similar constraints. This T is the gradient of the lapse, and so it should be curl-free. And this guy, this M, was the gradient of the shift, so it also needs to be curl-free. So you can add multiples of those guys. And you can see by adding multiples of those, you add terms that have derivatives of all of these other fields in them, and those change the characteristic matrices.
What are the evolution equations you started with?
I don't know. So it's the standard, quote, ADM equations that were not written down by ADM. So, yeah, probably. So the ones you copy out of Misner, Thorne, Wheeler, or York's papers.
York has RIJ.
I don't know which one of
it.
So, it just differs by terms of order that. So I don't really care because we're going to put in sort of arbitrary multiples of all of these things. Almost nothing works. I mean, we'll do some counting in a minute. Okay, so when we started doing this, we started adding just a few things, looking for a simple system, and we kept failing. So finally we got sick of it. We said, okay, let's add the most general thing you can possibly write down, and it turns out there were 15 different such terms that we could add to the equations and still make them only functions of the metric and not of epsilon IGK, you know, getting the parity right and stuff like that. Okay, so when you do that, then it turns out there are choices of this S alpha beta which make the system symmetric. And in fact, in the end, we ended up with a 14 parameter family of symmetric things. But let's just do some counting. So we started off with 19 parameters here that we could choose freely, 15 more parameters there, and we only ended up with 14. Okay, so out of this, whatever it was, 35-dimensional parameter space, there's only a 14-dimensional subset, which actually is symmetric hyperbolic. So it's hard to find that by shooting darts, because it's a very low-dimensional system. Okay, so we've done that, and you can read about all of the gory details in our paper if you're interested. Let me just summarize what we've done. So we've constructed this explicitly symmetric hyperbolic representation of the Einstein equations coupled with these dynamical gauge conditions. The gauge evolution equations were constructed in this way, which we hope will generate time-independent representations of time-independent geometries when they occur. We'll see whether that really works. The systems we constructed are manifestly linearly degenerate, and therefore the folklore and perhaps real theorem, as soon as I get a look at it, states that you will not develop gauge shocks, so we don't have to worry about that. These systems end up with 14 free parameters that you can use to adjust the characteristic speeds of the system, and we've been able to show that in this 14-parameter space, there is a region in which all of the characteristic speeds are less than the speed of light, for example, and that means you can still do black hole excision in the usual ways without worrying about stuff leaking in from the horizon. And finally, in addition to all of these parameters I've already talked about, which is many more than most people like to tolerate, you can actually introduce a lot more by changing what you think of as your independent dynamical field. So for example, instead of using the extrinsic curvature, we could take the extrinsic curvature plus some multiple of its trace and choose that new quantity as our independent field. So when I first heard of that as an idea, it seemed to me like a totally stupid transformation. Why just change the names of things? But numerically, people have shown that the stability of the evolution depends a lot on making the right choices of those kinds of parameters. So just for completeness, in some sense, we showed in our paper that you can extend these systems by making, I think it's an additional 19-parameter set of these linear-type transformations that take traces out of things and redefine variables. And so you end up with a system that I think has 35 free parameters that you could use to control stability or whatever you want to do with them. Okay, so that's basically all I have to say.
I'd like to ask a probably stupid question. What's wrong with the harmonical choice?
I don't.
Laps and shift satisfy the harmonic decomposition, which would be some differential system for them.
Yeah, so I don't know. Okay, that's the honest answer to that. So the only thing that I don't know about that system is how do harmonic coordinates behave as you try to approach a time-independent state? So it seems to me that there isn't any built-in control, and so if you did a binary black hole evolution, it settled down into a Kerr solution. I would have guessed that the harmonic coordinates that you would end up representing that Kerr in.
As far as your condition, what's wrong with their equations?
So one of his conditions was that asymptotically, when you reach stationarity, he wants.
Yeah, I would like to do that. And I don't have a theorem that proves that our choice will do that either.
Yeah.
But my sense is that there's no guarantee that harmonic things, it seems to me that there's no control at all in.
But you can't put two accurate in harmonic coordinates, so it must be in the system, right?
Well, there exists time independent harmonic representations of Schwarzschild. That's certainly true. But there's also a lot of time dependent harmonic representations of Schwarzschild. And on the average, if you ask me to bet, you know, which one are you going to end up with numerically, you know, it's going to be a time dependent one.
But your system would have the time independent one in there?
Yeah, so what's the difference in the equation? This is the question, maybe. So why do you think that these equations are going to go to the time independent? Or the ones that you were saying, well, this post-dam group or something, right? There's some experiments that did, but is there some intuition why we should go to time independent?
They did have some experiments which it seemed to work.
Right.
Right, but then we learned them post-facto.
So do I have a theorem or even an outline of a theorem of, you know, prove this or no, I don't. Right. So that's something that, you know, the mathematicians here could help us out on, I think, is coming up with a framework of designing gauge conditions that would do a better job of doing that. I mean, it's not just aesthetics, it seems to me, right? So it would be nice to have things in a time-independent representation, okay, from an aesthetic point of view. But there's also some numerical advantage to that, right? So if the state you end up with is some very horribly time-dependent thing, the numerics is just going to have a harder time representing that in an accurate way.
But on the other hand, when having a gauge that will naturally represent the stationary solution in a nice way, that's not necessarily what one would be looking for. If you're really you already have a gauge that can go around and simulate the binary black hole collision, eventually give you a pair code that's going to the stationary solution. Well, your main problem was in the evolution. So if your gauge actually went through that well, maybe it doesn't necessarily have to go to a pair solution at the end.
That's right. So if you could get almost to the end and then switch gauges to some other, I mean, there's lots of things one could try. I'm just telling you how we made some set of choices, and there's lots. The nice thing about gaze, you can do anything you want, right?
But that also suggests that it's unlikely, right? I mean, right. So there is actually a way of doing these gauges which will asymptotically be okay. And this is coming from this isolated horizon framework, actually.
Right.
So there are these coordinates which one can write down, and there are using Einstein's equation people in Poland, everyone written down the expansions of the matrix, how they should look like. I mean, these are only tether expansions, so of course, numerical relativity will really fix the closed form. But the problem is exactly what Luis was saying, that they don't seem to be well adapted to the really dynamical phase. They seem to be well adapted to the asymptotic phase.
Right.
And so there does seem to be a tension between the two things. And can one.
Right, but taking these. So the equations that are sort of nice asymptotically are these elliptic type conditions. Okay, and promoting those two damped hyperbolic equations, it seems to me that that plausibly provides this transition. And in the fully dynamical situation, they behave like wave equations with speeds that you can control by setting all of those different constants, with damping coefficients that keep you from developing sort of big ringing solutions that damp you toward solutions of the elliptic equation. So it seems to me that there's some chance that is a strategy that will bridge the gap.
But there are nonlinear hyperbolic equations.
Oh, yeah.
They're linear elliptic, but nonlinear hyperbolic. Is that correct? I mean, I was reading it correctly.
Well, the principal parts of the equation are linear. I mean, they're quasi-linear.
Well, I thought you essentially have a wave operator acting on the lapse, but the wave operator involves the lapse.
Yeah, so this term there is just put in to make the final characteristic matrix that you end up with is just lapse times some function of the metric. So that determines what powers of lapses that we put in there. You can put any powers you like, but so it's.
Divide by m squared, it makes the proper time derivative, roughly speaking, there.
Right, exactly. And that's the reason why that the lapse appears in the way that it does in the usual Einstein equations.
Do you have some feeling for, there's sort of a no group and some of the parameterization of things that sort of fix lapse and shift. How much you have to couple this with the dynamic lapse and shift? How much that sort of changes things, or is it sort of a fairly minor modification to the measure?
So I don't know the answer to the interesting interpretation of that question. That interpretation, how does it change the numerical solutions? Because we don't really have the code up and running.
How does it change the parameter? You get a certain sets of parameters that give you nice hyperbolic systems at one point. Is that adding in the damp question shift, does it sort of mess those up, or just sort of add an extension?
It complicates things in a pretty horrible way. I mean, you've got a lot more fields. So the fixed gauge systems had, 36 fields? Is that right, Larry? 30 fields, right. And we're now up to 46, so it's 50% bigger
The parameters don't match, right? I mean, you have the nice ones, kind of like Goldstrom, but they're not putting the same parameters in the same.
No.
So you have to start over.
We don't know enough to know even that. But they're unlikely to be the same.
Right, you're going to make a
casting. Yeah. Since
then you have worked very hard to avoid this gauge short.
Yeah.
Have you seen an example of that?
Well, I mean,
numerical evolution, that you start with small data, I'm developing something that satisfies the strict definition of shocks on this.
But you can do it, right?
No, you can do it.
Schwarzschild and put a stupid labs that will go out like here and say that
you have to. The experiments that I've seen, you have to work hard to actually put it in to develop it.
So, I mean, so let me rephrase what you just said, because you guys have been working on this for decades. You have intuition about what works and what doesn't. And for you to go far away from what works to make it fail is hard work, because it's something you just wouldn't do. But for people like me who are just coming in completely naive, I don't know what works, right? So I would just try anything. And what I would like to do is avoid things that I can avoid, so that when something crashes, the list of things I have to go down to try to fix it is shorter.
What experiment have you seen in which this thing developed?
So the papers that Miguel wrote is where my intuition comes from.
You tailor the experiments to create the show.
Okay.
No, but it's kind of just heuristic slicing. We've done the weird initial slicing.
I just want to make a brief comment on what is a nice gauge. There's two things. If one has a killing vector in the space time, killing vector timeline, then one thing I would like to do is that if one has any arbitrary initial slice with initial coordinates on it, I would want that transporter to be along the killing vector, be dragged along the killing vector. And that's a condition that one can impose. And I think harmonic coordinates will do that. Like any other good coordinate choice, like maximal or whatever. And
state the condition again. Go ahead. What? So, what is the condition that you want to impose?
Well, if you have a killing vector in the space-time,
yes,
you have an arbitrary slice of arbitrary coordinates on it.
Yes,
that coordinate is lead dragged by the killing vector.
Okay.
But
checking to see whether things are lead dragged is very complicated.
No, it's not. So that's true for basically all. That's what got.
I mean, it is if the killing field is not d by dt.
No, but you just don't have to work in coordinates. It's just geometric geometry. Anyway.
So I agree. We can check to see whether there are killing fields in ways that don't involve looking in coordinates.
Sorry. What I meant is, for arbitrary abstract condition, you want that to be true if there's a killing field, right? That's what you said earlier.
But I claim that will always be true, no matter what the coordinate conditions are. If you just define geometrical quantities like Lie transport, that doesn't depend on the coordinates.
Well, anyway, to come to my actual point is...
Yes. And this was short because Aina was about...
At late times, your slice may be really quite bad, and then if it's Lie dragged along, it's not going to get any better. So there's that problem as well.
Okay, we can argue about this. Go ahead, Aina.
Does the fact that your gauge variables are not part of your hyperbolic system, does that give us any advantage in trying to formulate boundary conditions?
I don't know. Boundary conditions is another can of worms, so, as we all know. Any more questions?
No questions.